What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Do Not Enter podcast, where today, the poison proves more deadly than spice. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
I go at you with my left.
And Nolan Zhang.
And I parry with my right.
Okay, well, here we are with the fighting already.
Word fighting.
Yeah, word fighting, indeed. So yeah, welcome back. This is episode, again, I don't know what, but we're going over the third of chapter 35, or the last third. Again, we split the chapter into three parts, so we will be starting at the part where it says, right after where it says, won't be a one of them can escape fear of me because of this day. So right after that, that's where we start. I know, that's... Fade needs to go back to English class and spend less time in the arena, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, so...
What a
yeah.
dork, could he?
Right, so so how have y'all's last 2 weeks been? So actually we took the last week off because we had a few deadlines to meet, right? But so now we're back and better than ever. Honestly, that November 1st deadline is the worst, I think.
It was killer. Halloween was spent.
It was a very spooky Halloween indeed.
Yeah.
With the deadline fast approaching.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty chilling though.
Yeah,
I got mine in pretty early.
Yeah,
like a week in advance.
Yeah, what a king.
Also, today I have my first like homemade lasagna instead, like, you know, the school ones, and I thought it was great. Like, I've never had lasagna made homemade with handmade pasta really too. Good. That was so good.
Oh really?
That's my friend's birthday.
I've never had lasagna, actually.
Really?
No, I just don't, because I don't eat like cheese stuff, so.
Yeah, that's true. Like,
yeah.
Are you like lactose?
No, just personal preference. Yeah, just personal preference.
I mean, I respect it.
Honestly, yeah, cheese is not really like a staple choice of mine either. But yeah.
Yeah, I just never got used to it. I don't remember why, but like, I've never had a liking for cheese. Like, I don't remember why or when that started, but that's just me, you know.
It just stuck with you.
Yeah, me and cheese, we are not the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what we're saying is quite sacrilegious to some of your audience members, but it's just the truth. Like, we don't all vibe with cheese, you know. There's us people in this world.
No, I just don't understand, and you know, some listeners are bound to be offended, but I just don't understand the people who just pour cheese on top of everything. And...
I don't completely understand it either, even though I love cheese.
Oh yeah, I
mean, it's like chill out, like, they don't need that much.
Yeah, they're trying to overload, you know. There's just so much, it's just, you know, spilling cheese everywhere. You know those people who like pour like liquid cheese on top of burgers or something?
Ocean
of
cheese.
Yeah. Burgers?
Cheese,
I mean,
ocean.
I people dip, but like, I don't. Yeah.
Oh yeah,
I
no.
Mean, like,
yeah.
I think nacho cheese is pretty good, but like, I don't know.
Oh really? I just avoid cheese as much as possible. Other than like pizza, which is really weird. I don't know why. I'm okay with pizza.
Probably because pizza's mixed with other stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of tomato sauce and stuff. So
yeah,
you know, you don't actually taste like the cheese texture as much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the flavor. Yeah. But
we
anyways.
Move on from cheese.
Yeah, we do want to move on from cheese because this chapter towards the end. Well, I can't say it's very cheesy. That kind of ruins it. Yeah. So anyways. Yeah, so before we start, let's do the quotes. So again, you know, the quotes, we'll just read our favorite quote from the chapter and then later we'll discuss it. So Fillmore, again, you have the first quote.
Okay, my quote this week is very short and sweet. It goes, "It's easier to be terrified by an enemy you admire."
And you've said that, but your quote is actually the longest out of our three. So
yeah.
So we've picked very short quotes and very memorable ones, I should say. This chapter was full of them. But my quote was, "Your tortures cannot hurt a dead man." So
that is good.
Yeah.
My quote goes, "Guilt starts as a feeling of failure."
Ooh, and I know that feeling of failure all too well.
Yes, sir.
We're gonna know it really well soon.
Yeah, the laugh of pain. Oh no. Anyways, yes. Oh well.
Okay.
Indeed. So yeah. Well, Fade doesn't know the feeling of failure. So, he was pretty close to failing, but he ended up succeeding. So, we'll discuss that later in the chapter. Right.
Yeah.
We're a little bit off track today. It's been a few weeks, but. Yeah, so let's get started. So so Fillmore, why don't you take it away?
Okay, so starting off from the cliffhanger from last time, Fade begins his deadly duel with the gladiator in front of him, and the fight begins with this description. Fade gave ground slowly before the gladiator's crab-like advance. Arena sand grated underfoot. He heard the slaves panting, smelled his own sweat and a faint odor of blood on the air. You can honestly feel the intensity in the air.
Yeah, I mean,
it's really descriptive. Like, I caught the imagery really deeply.
Yeah, it's just really dramatic. I mean, these duels, right? I don't know. Did they ever mention, though, whether the arena is, like, quiet during duels or whether it's loud?
I'm pretty sure it's always rowdy.
Always rowdy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember if they ever mentioned that. That listeners, feel free to correct us if we're wrong. But basically, it just... In the case it's so rowdy, it just heightens the drama because he can hear the panting of the gladiator amidst all of this noise, right? This white noise. So it's almost, there's all this background, but it's all blurred and we're just zoomed in on these two guys duking it out, right? I mean, so.
On his opponent, mm-hmm. not on anything else.
Yeah, he's just hyper-focused.
Yeah, I think that's like really... my admiration for athletes and anyone who competes is just that their ability to remain focused even when there's like everyone else around them. Like all they see is their go, and they're good at that. I think that's like the biggest thing.
I mean, it's just, I was just watching the World Series, right? Because I mean, we are Texans, but you know, just watching. Oh yeah, by the way, but just, you know, just watching them, you know, hit home runs and stuff, even when, you know, you can literally hear all the background noise and it's so loud, right? And it's definitely louder. You could, probably the stadium is shaking, you know, with all the noise, all the decibels, right? But
crazy.
Yeah, so I don't know, just being able to laser focus like that, that's, you know, some talent. And that's kind of what Fade and the Gladiator are. They're in their mind, they're the only two people in this world right now. You know, they're just the fighting people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, Fade Rauta actually has some mind game of his own when he was fighting a gladiator. So when we read how Fade Rauta fights, we can tell that Fade Rauta really likes to play a lot with fire, and he's a real crowd pleaser. He literally like fakes a stumble, and then he barely dodges the attack of the slave gladiator, only thanks to his youth, really, just to lodge the second barb into the slave gladiator's arm. Like, to be honest, no seasoned like veteran fighter would have risked like such a risky move versus an opponent that they just like never tested before, like that they have just, like no knowledge of. I think it really shows Fade's like personality and riskiness and just his ability to like please, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if he's this prone to taking random risks that could get him killed, you know, in these types of situations, because it's not just two people with a pillow fight, you know, this is a massive, you know, he could literally die here. I mean, then he might not be, you know, so competent as a ruler, right? Because if he's applying this mentality to all of his life endeavors, I mean, there'll be one day where someone outwits him and he's not as sharp as he thought, right? And that day will be his last. I mean, that he won't get
the
around
prize before the fall.
Yeah, I mean,
he thinks he's a lot more than he actually
is. He thinks he's a hot shot, but in reality he's a, I don't know, something not
he's
a hot
he's
shot.
He's not a hot shot. He's a cold. I don't know. What's the opposite of shot?
I don't know. Alive.
A cold something.
Yeah, a cold something. Yeah, alive.
He'll be a cold turkey.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I don't know. That made sense in my head.
Uh-huh. Anyways.
Okay. Anyways, as the fight progresses, Fade hears the cheers of the crowd and thinks it's easier to be terrified by an enemy you admire, which is coincidentally my quote of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And this quote was actually taught to Fade by Hawat, or taught to him by Hawat. And I thought this was interesting because Fade is actually talking about himself, and the audience is admiring Fade's movements and fighting abilities, but that makes them all the more terrifying. And Fade goes on even further, and he says that, "Let the family see me do this thing. I am their enemy. Let them think of me as they see me now." And this shows how serious he is about the fight and how it symbolizes his power. But I was kind of confused as to why he wants the family to see him as an enemy, like the crowd to see him as his enemy, or what. Well, I'm not sure what he was talking about, to be honest.
Yeah, so I think in a partial way, the speculation that we had like early on in the introduction, Fade Rauta, and like when the Baron like brought him into the room with Peter, right? We're kind of right that he would be the wild card for the Harkonnens. So like, if he obeyed the Harkonnens, he would like really be their savior. But if he disobeyed, he might be their downfall. So in a way, we were right, right? Because Fade does seem to hate his family for some strange reason, which might not be so strange because he had a bad history with his uncle. Not sure how bad, but it was bad enough that he doesn't like him this much. So he proves to be a massive danger to any side that he is on, because Faye doesn't seem to also, like, he seems so sadistic that he's not going to, like, cooperate with Atreides either. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I feel like he's too ambitious to actually just, like, succumb to whatever authority. So he seems to be kind of his own entity, and he really wants to have this arena fight establish his own authority to the point where, like, everyone gives him a wide berth, you know? Mm-hmm. Like a good
right.
distance.
Right. I mean, it's honestly pretty likely he could, you know, just bring down the Harkonnens from within. He's the X factor in more ways than one, right? Because he takes these crazy risks, he rules their fear, and eventually his iron fist will foster discord and people won't be happy with how he's ruling. And I mean, he's unreliable, he's dangerous, and I'm just spitting adjectives, and you know, he seems to have too much pride and confidence. It could lead to his downfall, and these are not good qualities, especially in a brand new inexperienced ruler, right, who seems to be far too hot-headed for his own good.
And his advisor is Hawat, and you know Hawat isn't the most reliable.
I don't know how they came to trust him so quickly, but Hawat has his ways. So anyway, so back to the fight, which is actually my quote for the week. So the gladiator says, "Your tortures cannot hurt a dead man." So I mean, honestly, I can't help but feel he's speaking for all of the Atreides when he says this, considering how scattered and close to dead they are, right? Because, yeah, he's basically about to die in the arena, and he knows that, you know, he'll die without the Ilaka drug or with the Ilaka drug. Either way, he knows he's going to die, right? But he's so desperate to take Fade with him into death. And it's just, I feel hinting at later events when the man, you know, stabs himself in a superhuman effort, right? Spoilers. This cornered animal mentality, I mean, we've mentioned it a lot, but, you know, the cornered animal is the most unpredictable. And at this point, especially the gladiator really has nothing to lose. He even believes he's, at least the cornered animal still believes that they have a shot of survival, right? This man literally believes he is dead. And so that I think that's the scariest thing of all, right? I mean, if this Atreides goes down, it's really not without a fight. So that's
honestly, I kind of respect that mentality though, because it's like you're always fighting till the end and you never give up.
Right, but honestly, like, it's honestly even further. I feel he's given up, and that's why he feels that with his last moments in life, he wants to, you know, make an impact, right?
I guess he's given up on life, but he hasn't given up on taking him down.
I suppose that's better.
He changed his priorities, basically. Mm-hmm.
Agreed. Yeah. Right.
Honestly, facts. Like, some people describe the feeling as being, like, really freeing when you have nothing else to live for except that one singular goal. Like, to have only a single priority when you have, like, there's nothing stopping you. Well, like, there is something stopping you, but, like, that's all you have to worry about. Some people describe it as, like, freedom, escape.
Honestly, I wish I could feel that freedom right now, but
school
and college
apps. School and college apps. Yep, I feel everyone feels the same.
Many factors tying us down.
Well, to continue the narrative, Fade begins to get overpowered by the gladiator, and he begins to put his cheat into action. And if you guys can't remember, he says the keyword scum, and it basically paralyzes the slave. And in this case, he says the word scum, and it opens a space between him and the slave, which gave him enough time to inflict a poisonous wound on him. And the fact that Fade was getting beat up by the slave, I think that just shows that he's nowhere near Paul in skill, and that he just needs to resort to underhanded tricks to beat someone. So I guess if there's ever a fight between Fade and Paul, it's going to be a fight of skill versus dirty tricks.
Yeah, to be honest, Fade's like fighting style definitely relies on a lot of gimmicks. And while gimmicks can carry you kind of far, especially in, like, I guess an inexperienced opponent, like against someone like Paul, who's clearly superior but also can calculate like all the gimmicks, I guess, in a way,
he's kind of screwed.
Not gonna work out. Like, unless Paul doesn't account for it, like that's when a gimmick is dangerous. So he's really like hedging his bets and whatever gimmick he's gonna keep, I guess, in the final fights that are coming up. But really, like, Fade just like a conniving little snake, you know. He's like deceiving the crowd, his family, but also like the gladiator in front of him. Truthfully, I kind of think that if the gladiator wasn't so talented, like wasn't so like intent on killing Fade, he probably wouldn't have known the tradition of the poison blade and which knife it's usually on. Because right now that he does know, he's kind of like really hung on to the idea of like being poetic with the symbolism of killing Fade with his own poison blade. I feel like that's kind of a trap in this scenario.
I mean, honestly, the fact that Paul could defeat a Fremen fighter fairly in a 1v1, and the fact that it happened so recently, you know, it's just such a recent chapter, just kind of indicates that Herbert might want to directly contrast these two fights, right? Because the context is so different. Paul is not fighting for honor, right? He's approaching the fight with honor, but he's not fighting for honor, and he's reluctant to kill. And Fade just approaches with this dirty cunning and trickery, and Fade is very willing to kill, and he's trying to make a point for his honor, right? So there's some message here. I mean, I won't get too far into attaching, you know, common tropes to these characters. I feel like Herbert's trying to hint at something somehow, you know, some more evidence that they sort of foil each other.
Not to mention, Fade has all the advantages, while Paul, he was in an unfamiliar area with an unfamiliar fighting style, and he still came out on top.
Right. Fade had all the advantages, and he almost didn't come out on top.
He
wouldn't have without that trigger word. Without the trigger word, almost, you know, he would have gotten stabbed with the white blade.
I mean, it didn't have poison, but it still may have been fatal.
It still would have been fatal. I mean, it's literally a knife.
I think while Fade's scheme truly was quite simple in nature, it still carries a much powerful message to anyone who's spectating. Because like moving past just like this gladiator fight, I would be honestly really intrigued in the development of the Harkin and family dynamics, especially because Fade is scheming from within to overthrow his uncle, the Baron, right? And hopefully, I don't say I like Fade's inner thoughts, but I do want to see more of it, because like, even though it lacks the eloquence found in other people's thoughts like Kynes, I feel like it is essential to really getting insight of how Harkonnen thinks, especially as Paul's foil. It's just super nice to see the contrast between him and Paul.
Yeah, because generally Paul has pretty wholesome thoughts, right? And then Fade, I mean, his little mental train of thought is just so twisted and cunning at the same time, right? Because, I mean, I respect and hate him for it, because he says stuff like, let them think on this slave who tried to turn the knife he thought poisoned and use it against me. Let them wonder how a gladiator could come into this arena ready for such an attempt. And let them always be aware that they cannot know for sure which of my hands carries the poison. So there's three things here that he implies with this kill. And it is implies, because I honestly would never have really noticed most of this, but everybody playing politics definitely would notice this. One, the gladiator is dangerous, just like their enemies, and, you know, the gladiator is unpredictable, just like their enemies, right? So the second thing is, the gladiator was led in by someone inside the Harkonnen circle, so there's treachery within their midst, right? And three, that Fade himself is unpredictable, and it's best to fear him and look up to him. And here he's essentially centralizing the power in himself, right? So he's taking the power, and he's saying, you know, I own this power, and you must fear me, because look what I can do, right, to you if you dissent.
Like,
so
go against me, and this will happen to you.
Yeah, it's such a multifaceted message, you know, that it's just kind of crazy how he comes up with stuff like this. Yeah,
I mean, I thought it was more like Hawat's theme, but I can't tell how much of it's Fade's own thoughts and how much of it's Hawat's thoughts. But I feel like Hawat really added that multi-layer message.
I would agree.
I think Fade was like already quite cunning in his own right, but Hawat really pushed him over the edge.
Yeah, just boosted that kind of. That's. I mean, it's Hawat as a mastermind. I mean, what can we say? He's one of the most talented mentats ever. So I mean, this is easy light work for him.
Light work. Yeah, so actually, when the gladiator was dying from the poison, from the actual poison on the long blade, an orthographic like thing popped up on the slave's face. So I kind of imagine that's some type of projected display that kind of like notified the gladiator and the audience of the slave's inevitable death. I like imagine like a screen, kind of like a holographic screen, showing a skull face of like cause of death, poison, you know, like whatever poison it was. I don't know.
I mean, it's kind of weird, because it reminded me, I was watching the very end of the League of Legends World Finals, right? And then after, I saw it on Twitter, actually, but it's just like when one of the teams lost, you know, the screen behind them flashed this big defeat, and it was this black defeat. I mean, there's such a way to rub it in, right? Like, my gosh, it's just...
It's because, you know, as someone who's been watching League of Legends, like, finals for the past like several years, it was so sad because Faker was going to end his career this year, and we really went, okay, at least as a Faker fan, I really wanted to be on a win, but you know, second is all right, you know, like second is first loser.
Is the first loser. It's still first.
When you mentioned League of Legends, I thought Nolan was rubbing off on you.
Oh, no, it wasn't. I just, I just saw somebody posted it on Twitter. Yeah, so.
Yeah. I mean, did you guys know that Nolan is the first League player to touch grass?
Oh.
Oh, my God.
I don't know about that one. I think it was Daps.
Oh, wait. Maybe he's the second Daps. One.
Yeah, probably the second one. Okay. Yeah, I said the second out of two people total. Yeah,
I mean, League of Legends has some like really good music though.
Oh, does
some
it?
Of their promotional videos are really good.
I have never played League of Legends actually. So
it's like the videos that they post on YouTube. Oh. And, Arcane too is really good apparently.
Riot is like at times more of a production company than the actual game company. You know? Oh God, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, Michael Chu used to work for them. So
oh okay, yeah.
Anyways, okay, yeah. Well, moving on from that. So, what a dramatic death the slave had. His last words were, "One day, one of us will get you."
Oh, and then he dies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he kind of like stabbed himself.
Oh before, yeah. Well. Yeah,
but we don't talk about that until later.
Yeah.
So I think this is foreshadowing at its finest. Do you guys agree?
I mean, honestly, no, because I feel like already see the path happening, you know, like I feel like it is a lot of dramatic build-up because this gladiator is like promising forever like vengeful death, but like because I see Fade as Paul's foil, I don't really expect Fade to lose to anyone else until he gets to the final epic battle between him and Paul, you know. After all, if you notice, like both Paul and Fade had their first 1v1s where we got to see their skill level and like person-to-person combat. So I expect this to like to not just be some passing like event that Herbert did to like develop Fade's character, but I really believe that Herbert would build upon it and like really lead up to a singular conversion of both of them meeting up and having like another of their own arena fights.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. But his words will still come true. So one of them will get
it. I guess like in a way, yeah. But like more on Paul's part.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the Baron goes down soon. I mean, somehow Fade has to come to power, and if the Baron goes down, I mean, it would make an epic chapter or two, so that would be cool, right? But I mean, yeah, signs are pointing towards Fade rising to power, and it's pretty much unavoidable, but we don't think that I don't think he'll die anytime soon, right?
Yeah, he doesn't seem like...
Yeah, he doesn't seem like the type of... He doesn't seem like the type of character that Herbert will kill off, you know, cough, Kynes.
Ouch.
Yeah.
I don't know. Fade just seems to be like an arch nemesis in development that you have to like really get to the peak before chopping off.
I'm still salty about Kynes because I invested so much heart into that character, and now he just went poof in a chapter.
Kynes would be like your wingman, you know, like the protagonist wingman.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Kynes is that turns into the mentor figure now that Jessica can't fit there, right? So anyways, it's an old wound. Every time it's fresh.
Yeah. Oh well.
I mean,
at least there's Johnny, right?
Yeah. Yeah, at least Paul has someone else for him.
Okay. Oh. So we see that the slave also takes himself out before Fade gets the chance, which makes Fade admire him and think that here was truly a thing to fear. And that which makes a man superhuman is terrifying.
Yeah. I mean,
I think with Fade is that like one thing he can do is recognize superhuman strength, but what he really fails to do is he really fails to understand the source of the superhuman strength. Like, obviously he knows it's the man's loyalty to the Atreides and like his revenge, like he's hell-bent on revenge. But the thing is, Fade can never really understand what it feels like as he holds no deep love for his house or any individual besides himself. And I think it really encapsulates it with like the phrase that which makes a man superhuman is terrifying. It's just like foreshadowing to me instead of like a passing thought of Fade's.
Yeah, I mean, you never know what pushes a man over his edge into superhumanity, right? I mean, it's always these critical situations, do or die, and then that's when you know, it's the facilitates this, you know, this crazy super inhumane power. Well, not inhumane, but inhuman power. Yeah.
I mean, it's honestly, like, it's the thing with adrenaline as well. Like, I mean, people can push cars off other people with adrenaline pumping through.
Yeah, I've heard of stuff like
some
that.
Crazy feats going on.
Mm-hmm.
I like, honestly, the only thing you can ask for in life is to have a really cool moment like this in your death-defining moment. Like, I don't want to just like die like in a bad way, you know? Or like, I mean, I guess peaceful is another like good way, but like the peak way to die is to be remembered as like a superhuman like hero. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm gonna die of cancer, I'd rather go to like Russia's bloody Vostok or something, and then like put down mines or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. Just another quick thing I found interesting, though. Like, it's also really funny that the count and lady are smiling after this, and the lady says, "You know, yes. His synaptic responses are very swift." So that's so just weird. It's such a two-faced compliment. I don't even know what. Like, it's such a funny and twisted way of praise. I don't even know what she's trying to say.
Why did she just say his reaction speeds are good?
Yeah, his synaptic responses are
very. Major right now.
Yeah, it's such
synaptic responses are very sweet.
It's not
creepy.
Yeah, it's I mean, yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, don't know what that implies. I mean, it could factor into what we see later in the chapter, or it could not. But anyways, thought I'd point it out because I had a good laugh at that one. Mm-hmm.
That's it true. Was quite the interesting dialect, this anyway. Yep. Yeah. So it looks like Fade's plan, or I should say Hawat's plan, is working out because the Baron is very angry with the slave master, and he's going to have him dead over a slow fire this night.
Ooh, roasted. Slave master meat. Oh, no. Not yum. That's...
It's probably the Baron's favorite food, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't put that past him.
But getting back on topic, we still don't know why Hawat wants the slave master replaced, though.
That's true. Like, maybe it's because, I don't want to speculate too much, but what if the slave master was actually one of the ones that had some sort of allegiance to the Harkonnens other than, like, some form of dependency or, like, threat being held over their head? Like, maybe what if the slave master truly was, like, unmovable by Hawat, that he needed a scheme of a way to eliminate him? So honestly, it's truly odd to me that while Fade does this to show his uncle that he is a monster to be feared, the Baron kind of fails to pick up on this. Instead, it's like freaking out over like the safety of his heir, you know? Like the Baron almost seems oblivious to the fact that Fade doesn't like him a lot. He kind of hates him, you know? That's kind of really weird.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if Fade hates him. I just think that he gives off this, you know, bratty teenager vibe, you know, yeah, I hate everyone kind of thing, right? Even when he was in the arena, he was just trying to spite the Baron with that announcement, right? But I mean, I don't think
he trolled the Baron.
Yeah, he did indeed. But I don't think Fade is necessarily trying to impress the Baron at all, anytime. Yeah,
yeah.
I feel like
reminds me of those, like, he reminds me of those kids where like their parents have them written in a will, and they're just like wondering, like, I don't know, not wondering, but like just like wondering like when their parents are gonna die, so they can.
Oh, like the entitled rich kids.
Yeah, like the entitled rich kids. So like. I get this half of the house, or like, this is my property. Like, it starts pointing and marking which one's theirs.
Oh, no, that's takes them out of their will.
Yeah.
Yeah. The deserved, honestly. Bad. Yeah, deserved. Yeah. I mean,
it's not good, to be honest. Guys. Yeah. Okay. Well, we see that not all is lost or fade. The crowd was chanting, head, head, head. But he refuses them and instead has the slave buried with his knives. Uh-huh. And that's basically cute. They were calling out head because they wanted to cut the dude's head off, but that didn't happen.
Right, yeah.
So I'm glad that Fade's pride isn't as twisted as the Baron's, at least not yet, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, when will you? I mean, the lady said, you know, we don't know how bad he'll get. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But one thing that I'm a little confused on it. So I can't tell if Fade's refusal of the slave's head is genuine like respect as a warrior for the slave gladiator, or if it's just like his attempt to correct the crowd's image of him as like a bloodthirsty arena fighter and to be viewed more as a respected, like, proper warrior figure that you know, as like a hero. Yeah. I don't really know if it's like a scheme or like just actual respect.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I honestly thought it wasn't so much general respect as he wanted to send a message, since this whole thing has been him sending messages, right? Because he says stuff like, They think they honor me. Let them see what I think. And also, they think they honor me with just a head, right? So it's so entitled against entitled brat much, right? But he's not satisfied somehow, and he wants to do things his own way. And I don't even know if he's
doing it out of spite.
I feel like that's what he's doing. I might be misinterpreting because I don't know these Harkonnen traditions. But yeah, so it seems like he's doing things out of spite.
But at the same time, he also says, like, bury him with his knives because he deserves it. So I don't know.
He might need to explain himself a bit, right? Because he is breaking tradition.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, he also did have a bit of respect, you know, in that superhuman quote, right? But I feel like a lot of it is just him wanting to be different. Yeah, he's just built different, you know. Yeah.
One thing that really disturbs me in this part of this chapter is that when we talk about the Baron and his internal monologue, the way that Herbert describes how he viewed Lady Farine's neckline, I don't know, like, it disgusts me knowing the Baron's interest in young boys, and it feels like utterly slimy how the Baron is viewing Lady Farine in that manner. Because the thing is, I mean, I don't really understand what is going on, because the Baron really didn't like Lady Farine, so I don't know if it's like some sort of changing relationship between them two and the Harkonnens, but like, otherwise it just seems so out of place. Like, I didn't need to be interrupted with like the whole like victory to like read that nasty little section.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I didn't really see that coming either. It's kind of out of place, but maybe it's just to continue emphasizing these weird thoughts going around, you know, floating around the Baron's head.
Intrusive thoughts.
Yeah, he's not proud of it, trust me.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... Yeah, the Baron, you know, he is a pretty messed up character, though, you know, with all of his plans. So this is one thing.
Probably the most messed up character in the entire series.
Yeah, in the book, especially so far, I feel like he's been, I mean, he ranks up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember? Oh, yeah. Never mind.
Yeah.
I was going to say something from a previous chapter, but I don't know if I can, like, accurately remember it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, so the Baron orders a fate in Fade's honor because he cannot let the people leave with their energies unspent. Mm-hmm. And for those wondering what a fate is, it's spelled F-E-T-E, and it's basically a celebration or a festival.
Yeah.
And I guess this means that the Baron isn't completely broke, seeing that he can actually afford to throw one of these.
Right.
That's true. Yeah. I definitely see it as a calculated move on the Baron's end to really appease the crowd and kind of make them forget a lot of the Harkonnen's oppression of their own people, because in a way it's like a massive band-aid that's needed to curb the people's anger and make them forget that, even if only just like there's one night of like partying, right, that they forget the Harkonnen's evil nature temporarily.
Right, and it's also really interesting that the Baron claims Fade could walk through the poorest corners of Harko without shield or arms, right? Because he must be really confident in the security of his city. Perhaps he's overconfident, even, you know, basically Fade is almost, you know, the same level as the president, and we know the president can't walk around without bodyguards and stuff. And not saying, you know, this is a futuristic, they probably have some other ways to enforce security, but, you know, no way some, you know, leading congressman or the president could walk around without their bodyguards, right? The Secret Service.
Yeah, no, right. Seen by Nancy Pelosi's incident.
Oh, yeah, her husband got attacked by some psycho.
I just briefly heard about that.
I thought it was fake news at first, but no. What the heck?
Yeah, that was...
You can't be doing stuff like that, guys. Yeah, like you just can't be walking around without your bodyguard.
Honestly, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Protecting yourself always.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay, so we get confirmation this chapter that the Count and Countess were speaking in that strange way on purpose, because in the passage it says, Count Fenring faced this lady, spoke again in their personal humming code tongue. You saw it, of course. And so I was wondering what you would actually need to know in order to decipher this code, because right now they just sound like Minecraft villagers.
Oh, yeah, they do sound like Minecraft villagers. I mean, now I suppose I have you to thank when I read the rest of the book imagining the Count and Lady with blockheads and hands in their sleeves, right?
Yeah, you hand them an emerald and they give you some spice.
Oh, well, that's a fair trade. Unlike emeralds, which are actually real spices and real, so... Yeah, anyways. But I think they decipher it probably, yeah, similar to the voice, you know, with these minor inflections in the voice, you know, that cause totally different meaning. So they probably are just super tuned in to stuff like that, all these different frequencies of pitch, right?
Yeah.
That would mean an account could, like, a guy, like, someone who's not a lady, like a Bene Gesserit lady, could definitely be taught these ways.
It's really like interesting, because knowing what I know of perfect pitch, right, it's not something easy to develop. Like, you can't develop it. And also, you know, if you don't have it, then you won't have it, right? Oh, because, yeah, so the fact that, you know, the count and the lady are, you know, they're, because they're, of course, they're varying pitch with the humming, because you can only have so many different sounds, right, with humming, so many different kind of rhythms, I guess. I don't really know what to call it. But, yeah, so they must have really, you know, good sense
intuitive
of
ears.
Yeah, some really good hearing capability. Yeah.
Yeah.
They have bat ears in the future.
Yeah. After deciphering different pitches for years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it also looks like they're aware that the entire performance was scripted and that it couldn't have been orchestrated by none other than Hawat.
Mm-hmm.
And the count also reveals that it was an error to demand the Baron to kill Hawat. And I wonder why this changes the entire situation so much. Like, why does Hawat coming into play change their mind about killing him?
Yeah, I was wondering if it was because, like, it revealed that Hawat is maybe still working behind the scenes to resist the Harkonnens, and that he has no plans on leaking any of the supposedly, like, feared Imperium's information to the Harkonnens. After all, I think one of the main reasons why the Count and Lady Femri wants Hawat dead is because they fear Hawat's vast knowledge could be employed by the Harkonnens as blackmail versus them and against the crown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, the Count and Lady have their personal reasons as to why they want the Baron overthrown, but we'll talk about that next. Yeah.
Well, it looks like the Countess has a plan of seducing Fade in order to make it more amenable to control. And that she'll plant deep in his deepest self the necessary prana bindu phrases to bend in. And I can't remember if this was mentioned earlier, but prana bindu, or I don't know how to pronounce it exactly, but prana bindu, maybe?
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if this is similar to the imperial conditioning that Yue went through, or it's just some form of brainwashing.
Uh-huh.
But I think this still gives us an idea of how Jessica's mother was able to seduce the Baron and get away with it.
Wait, but was it ever clear that Jessica's mother was Bene Gesserit? I can't remember.
No, she was an orphan, and like, I'm
not really sure, but I think it makes sense that her mother was a Bene Gesserit. Right,
I'll Google it real quick while you guys discuss.
Yeah.
I mean, that's potential spoilers, but whatever.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that's true. I probably shouldn't look, yeah.
For me, I mean, the prana bindu just seems to me a lot like brainwashing. I feel like it's more of a technique rather than like some type of like, I don't know, imperial conditioning. It seems more of like a setting almost. Like you have to like force, like you have to like train it, and then you have to like make sure that it stays on. Like you have to like reapply. I don't know. That's maybe what I think whenever it comes to Bene Gesserit. Like they can't just like indefinitely condition them.
Mm-hmm, yeah, maybe
it's like they're implanting something.
Yeah,
as it says, but it's like
maybe not somehow similar to the voice, where they somehow gain control of their faculties.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Without them that's even really I mean. Realizing. Yeah,
that's the scary part.
Yeah.
The thing that I don't really understand in this case is that, like, why must this be done? Like, why must they seduce? Like, why must Lady Femri, who obviously thinks that Fade Routh is immature and kind of dumb, must like undergo this and have a child with him? You know, like, what has been revealed to the Count and Lady Femri that they're willing to go this far in their approach to the Harkonnens, and now are working with them to the point of even going to like drastic as becoming a romantic partner of Fade Routh for like all in the name of humanity?
Yeah,
and like their discussion,
yeah, I mean,
like,
maybe not exactly romantic, but a partner.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it's
partner, yeah.
It's such a grand scheme, all in the name of humanity. It just sounds so grand, but really, you know, you doubt it. It's so grand that
it's
suspicious.
I really
it's hope it pays suspicious.
Off. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they sacrifice a lot.
Such a pervert. He likes getting cucked.
Oh yeah. I mean. Yeah.
I really hope
it
does.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, also something weird that Count Femri said in this conversation was just like, there's some ancient prejudices I must overcome, he said. They're quite primordial, you know? So they're talking about, like, what Lady Femi has to go to the lengths of, and he's like, you know, I have a lot on my plate too. Like, I don't really understand what he means, but like these ancient prejudices that Count Femi has to overcome that Lady Femi doesn't. I wonder if he's referring to like maybe gender roles, because like they're talking about Lady Femi's role in as like a woman to like necessary to seduce like Fade, right? And like to marry into the Harkonnen line to preserve the bloodline for humanity. So like, what if like, I don't really know. Like, is he talking about some kind of like his role in this entire scheme and like why he's doing so much or his responsibility?
I don't know because I think the ancient prejudice he has is this allowing this infidelity to happen just because you know, in today's modern societies, which in their case it would be primordial today's culture, right? They you know, today's society, you know, cheating is not, it's not very highly regarded, right? So just to say the least,
I think it's illegal.
Yeah.
Wait, is cheating illegal?
No, polygamy. Bigamy or polygamy is, but
I mean, yeah.
I mean, but you don't have to be a polygamist to cheat. Yeah. Most cheating isn't. I mean, you can't legally marry multiple people, so right? So yeah. I mean,
at least not in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there are still polygamous cultures in the world, but. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, maybe like South Asia or Middle East or stuff like that, maybe. Or maybe I'm being biased, but I don't know. So not that I know anything. Not that I know anything.
Promoting polygamy.
Yeah, not that I know anything about world culture, right. But I mean, basically, I'm confused because is this some crazy plan that the Bene Gesserit is trying to hatch, right? Because why must the Harkonnen bloodline be preserved as such? Because they don't know that
synaptic reflexes.
Yeah, they need those quick reflexes. They need those genes. Yeah. But you know, he's trying to unzip his genes, yeah. I mean, they don't know there's already Harkonnen blood in Jessica, right? Which is really weird because I don't even remember how Jessica found out that I think Paul told her somehow. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, but I don't know how Paul.
Right?
Yeah, Paul was calculating, but it's still really interesting how Paul was able to calculate that, right? But I guess nobody really knows. But it's just kind of dramatic irony then, I suppose, that they don't know there's Harkonnen blood in Jessica, and you know, somehow they're planning
there's also Harkonnen blood in Paul.
Yeah, and Paul too.
That changes everything.
And no matter what, even if they knew, you know, Paul and Jessica are basically believed to be dead, so. Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, somehow they're planning to oust Fade after, you know, all of this stuff happens because they're scared that he'll grow to be worse than his uncle. Maybe they just want to preserve the bloodline, get out, and then get rid of Fade. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of messed up, but yeah.
I mean, gotta do what gotta do for the plan.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's all about the plan. Yeah.
Uh-huh. God's plan. Just kidding.
Definitely not God's plan. Yeah, it doesn't.
No, but when that song first released, it went hard.
Oh God, yeah. But all these like plans within plans, only to have the Count bring in the possibility of failure, right? Like he's like threatening Lady Fairy with the distress of the guilt, saying my quote of today, guilt starts as a feeling of failure. So he's like trying to guilt trip her right now, and like, guilt really is a powerful emotion, and it's so difficult to shake off and remedy, especially since most of the time guilt's kind of lodged in the past in an action that's like regrettable and that you can never go back and fix. Mm-hmm. But particularly like times of failure definitely lead to a lot of overthinking and regret, which is exactly why guilt arises in the future, as you may wonder the reasons like why it happened. And typically you kind of end up blaming yourself because it's too late to blame anyone else, you know? Mm-hmm. And you wonder, like, why you let everyone down and, like, why, more importantly, you let yourself down. I find, like, Lady Femi's response to, like, the possibility of unlivable guilt for failure to meet the Bene Gesserit plan of saving like, humanity's bloodline, kind of cold in a way, kind of a red flag behavior as she simply goes, there will be no guilt. Like, there simply won't be any guilt.
Okay.
She's like, denies everything and like the possibility of failure. Like sure, denial is a coping mechanism. So like, it's interesting to see like,
isn't it the first coping mechanism too? So it's even going in order.
It's like,
it won't happen. It didn't happen. It never happened.
No, like for real. Like, I just want to see like, kind of curious. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. I'm really curious. Like what if it does fail? Like what will they do now? Like, I don't know. Like there will be like a dramatic change of heart. Where they'll be like, we're switching sides now. Like, GG, like, I give up. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean,
seems cool.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I guess we'll have to find out eventually, but for now, we know what the plans that's set.
Yeah, so I mean, at the same time, you know, I want to know, but I also don't want to know. So
that would,
but really, we will know because we're reading a book. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, and just like truly mysterious what the Count and Lady are saying to each other. I think like some of the traits that they do mention that they look for in humans are like union of breeding and training, but there must be more to that than for someone to become human, right? To be truly human or whatever they call it. Because it perplexes me why Count Femini wants to like save both Paul and Fade. Because right now it really seems like they're just settling for Fade.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think they're settling. Like,
dead.
Yeah, I think they're settling for Fade because Paul is quote unquote dead, as you just said, right? But it's also interesting how they want to preserve the bloodline, even though they preached this good union of breeding and training. It's like the classic nature versus nurture argument. You know, we need the bloodline, but we also need the training. I mean, they're looking for the best of both worlds somehow. So, you know, are they trying to play genetics here? I don't know. Yeah.
They want the talent and the training.
Yeah. So that's, you know, and the thing is, even, you know, a lot of times, you know, if you have two smart parents, not necessarily the kid is smart, right? So
smartness isn't exactly a gene. It's not gene based.
Even at least intelligence wise, and maybe physical qualities are more, I think, genetic, right? But I mean,
some people are born geniuses, though.
You never know. But honestly, after maybe 10,000 years of doing stuff like this and picking bloodlines so carefully, they probably got some result. Yeah.
Maybe they figured the genetic baby problem that we have in the modern day. Maybe they cracked the code.
Yeah, maybe they figured out how to edit genes. You know, they took
what
CRISPR
to the genetic baby problem we have right now.
It's unethical to create a perfect baby, or else like all the rich people would do it. That's like the problem. That's illegal to create a perfect baby, you know. Like we could try, like CRISPR and stuff, we could definitely try, but it's unethical.
Yeah, it definitely is. I feel just editing genetics of any human is unethical. Mm-hmm. I just feel
I think it might depend, because like if you're born with like a genetic defect, like
if you have
Down syndrome, then if you got rid of that, then you could like.
But then it's just hard to draw the line, you know. Once you get the ball rolling, I feel.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not here to argue ethics or whatever, but.
Right, and we're not. Yeah. We probably don't have to worry about this.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I'm just saying it because it's not even possible right now. So, anything right now is unsafe. So it's definitely unethical.
We're in that transition process right now.
Yeah, but you know, it's something that they've probably perfected in 10,000 years in the future.
Probably less than that, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it only took us how many years since civilization really started in the last 3,000 years. Or so, you know, even like with the Greeks back in and whatever. So
advanced civilization.
And we've only really had the scientific revolution for the last 500 years. So
we've gone this far.
We've come so far.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, so they got 20 times 500 years. what can they do with that?
They definitely got it.
They'll probably get it in within the next century, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when we say they, as if we're not them.
Because it's so confusing, you know, speaking from the past, but also speaking from the present with both of these two different but parallel timelines. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We must look so wacky, just three high school kids talking about the future.
We're not nearly qualified, but...
we're not.
But we just say whatever's on our mind. Yeah, that's kind of the point.
Okay, well, the chapter ends with the saying, "Do not count a human dead until you've seen his body, and even then you can make a mistake." This is obvious dramatic irony, and hopefully it's a sign that we'll be going back to Paul's point of view.
Yeah, yes. I mean, like, hopefully, right? Because, I mean, I haven't looked at the next chapter yet, but really, Getty Prime is this political snake pit, and I kind of want to check back in with our little Muad'Dib, right? See how he's going, how he's doing. I mean, I mean, honestly, on Arrakis, it's all about rituals, and here it's all about politics. So, so it's two sides of kind of the same coin, I suppose. But I mean, they're still kind of different. So it might provide
focus is elsewhere.
Some refresher.
Yeah. I really want to see Paul's training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see how he does. Mm-hmm, indeed. Yeah, well, on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Dune Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read to the end of chapter 36 and Dune in next time when we discuss it. Yes, we are back to full chapters, at least for the next chapter. Yeah, so as always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at Dune Not Enter, Reddit @u/DuneNotEnter, Twitter at Dune Not Enter, email us at DuneNotEnter@gmail.com. That is DuneNotEnter@gmail.com. Please contact us if you have any questions, feedback, or not my turn this week, right? Yeah, I think it's Nolan's turn.
Yeah.
Or correctons.
Okay.
Oh, correctons.
Hey, I mean, you still had the word correct in there, but I mean, that just implies a word correct, right? Yeah, so, but if we've made any mistakes, don't hesitate in letting us know. Please give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It only takes a few seconds of your time. So just go and make an account, of course, and then go to our show and click the 5-star button because, you know, it's the only one that exists. But the reasons are twofold. One, it encourages us to keep making content so that we can bring more content to you guys. And second, it really gets us up the charts. From a technical standpoint, right? Literally playing the numbers game. And and so that we can get Dune and our podcast to a wider variety of listeners. So yeah, we would really appreciate it if you could take the time to do that. Otherwise, that's about it. So have a great week and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye guys.